A small lump of bully beef let down with flour and potato, and on every third day the tinned McConachie's stew that was so foul it was almost a blessing to have it in ever smaller quantities as the convoys became harder to fight through to the island. Alistair grinned at his friend's displeasure. He pulled in the beer net while Simonson let out the trawling line.
"Do me a favour," said Simonson.
"Ask away,"
said Alistair, prizing the tops off the beers.
"If we don't catch a fish, butcher me and tell the cook I'm pork."
"Don't flatter yourself. It hasn't already occurred to me. I'm a sentimental fool for letting you have your beer first."
They headed for the land, pointing in to St. Paul's Bay, where the Apostle had been shipwrecked. Alistair had checked every particular of the account in Acts against the relevant Admiralty chart and found nothing wanting. He had been on Malta 3 months now, and he liked the way the island lived in the full embrace of time. In London, bedded in its clay, one viewed history as a reworkable legend, a great entertainment of doubtful veracity, and liable in any case to revision whenever the next mudlark waded into the Thames at low tide and pulled out some iconoclastic sherd. London was a crowd-pleaser, a Protestant, a voluntary amnesiac, living to disinter stories only to arrange their bones in a sly new order. But Malta was permanent rock, with barely a scattering of topsoil. Time, having nowhere to hide, had colonised the surface instead, and lay there with its full duration exposed. In niches in the limestone studded with fossil shells, Alistair had seen 8,000-year-old statuary hung with paper garlands on the feast days of the saints. In a tiny, dark, incense-smelling chapel into which he had strayed to have a moment away from the war, Alistair had found what he had thought might be a Caravaggio. The priest had neither known nor minded, had simply replied that the painting was by a local artist. Alistair finished his beer while it was still cold, and flipped the empty brown bottle over his shoulder into the depths. Their white wake hissed through the sea.
"What are you smiling about?" said Simonson.
"I had a love letter in this morning's post."
Simonson yawned.
"I get 3 a week.
But my family is not disgustingly wealthy, so I can actually take it as proof of my looks."
"Go to hell," said Simonson, "and tell them I sent you."
"I suppose you own the place."
51%, old boy. My main chain's a controlling interest."
"I'll be sure to keep it warm for you. She's called Hilda, by the way."
"I didn't ask."
"No, but you were curious."
"My curiosity about you, Heath, is the curiosity Freud had for hysterics, or Mendel for peas. You helped to confirm my theories."
"She's called Hilda, and she's fabulous eyes, like, well, I don't know, like themselves. They're unique."
Simonson looked thoughtful.
"Oh, Hilda, your eyes like a simile you wrote to a commoner in the military."
Alistair ignored him.
"She declares her love in the first paragraph."
"How impossibly vulgar."
"Oh, what now? What are you smirking about, vile man?"
"I'm flattered to have elicited such an unscientific response from you. It is only that one cannot condone willfulness, in women or in horses.
I'll be sure to let Hilda know.
If you'll loan me a sugar lump, I shall pop it in the envelope." "Surely you don't plan to dignify her with a response?"
"I can't say I've given it much thought."
Simonson ruffled Alistair's hair.
"That's more like it."
Alistair had, though. How honest and uncomplicated Hilda had been, snuggled up beside him at the Lyceum. It would have been convenient if he could have fallen in love with her and not Mary. They could have gone on weekends away, the four of them, and laughed with pristine teeth like those chummy couples in the ads for Blackpool Beach. He turned the nose of the dinghy further into the bay.
"Damn it," said Simonson. "Must we really go back?"
"Anyone would think you didn't enjoy the war."
"It's this island I can't stand."
"You don't find it exotic?"
"Heath, I detest Malta. Anywhere grain will not grow is no place for a man. My great hope is that one of the bombs will hold this island below the waterline and it will sink, and then we can all go home with the Navy."
"But you like the people, at least."
"I loathe the people. They are feckless and swarthy and nauseatingly loyal. They are hardly better than niggers."
"They've been hospitable to us."
"They've been hospitable to the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, the Romans, the Vandals, the Byzantines, the Arabs, the Christians and the French. If Mussolini had got here 5 minutes before us, the locals would be whistling Puccini."
"Wouldn't we be innkeepers too, if we happened to live on the crossroads?"
Simonson drew himself up.
If England has 28-ton breech-loading Mark 10 coastal artillery pieces, it is so that we need not the innkeepers.
Alistair laughed. Haven't you caught a fish yet? Simonson tugged on the line disconsolately.
It's the Kriegsmarine, isn't it? They radio our position to all the fish within a nautical mile.
When they were still 300 yards from shore, nearing the head of the bay, a fighter burst over the coastal bluff and dropped down almost to the sea. He headed straight at them. Alistair saw the pilot through the front panel of the aircraft's canopy, goggles up on his forehead, staring back with perfect surprise over the block of his radial engine. Alistair had time to think, oh, it's one of theirs. Then the plane was overhead, howling, barely missing the mast. The prop wash slammed into the sails, taking them aback and capsizing the dinghy. Alistair gasped in the cold waves. The boat lay on its side with the sails flat on the water.
"Now we shall have to dry out our tobacco." "You told me you could sail these things," said Simonson.
"It's just that the wind's a bit fluky at this end of the bay."
They clung to the transom while Alistair released the sails and made ready to right the dinghy.
"We'll swim the boat around so it's across the wind, then we'll bear down on the centre plate until we come up right again, all right?"
Simonson glared at the receding fighter.
"He's an Italian, isn't he?"
"I think so. I'll bet he's calling us in as a probable kill."
Simonson spat salt water.
"He's off home to have a sailboat stenciled on the side of his fuselage. His ground crew will administer fellatio."
As they began to swim the dinghy around, they heard the note of the fighter's engine change. The pitch and the volume increased. Alistair saw the top side of the wings with their fasces roundels and realised that the aeroplane was banking round and coming back at them. It happened faster than the mind could usefully process, so that a part of him braced for emergency while another part enjoyed the tight curve the fighter was making, the dipped wing almost clipping the waves and a firm white contrail arcing over the glittering sea. The nose of the fighter lined up on them again. There was nothing at all to be done. Simonson, in a quiet voice, called the pilot a stone-cold bastard. Then the fighter roared overhead again, and no shots had been fired.
"The devil is he doing?"
"He's getting lined up," said Alistair. "New to the job, I should think."
The fighter banked around again and came back at them. Alistair turned his legs towards the onrushing plane and lay back in the water, angling his body to present the soles of his feet as the smallest possible target. As he let himself sink back, he saw the Italian slide open the cover of his canopy. An ungloved hand emerged and let go something white, and as the plane roared overhead for the third time, the scrap of white floated down to the sea. The fighter receded. The note of the engine faded into the chatter of the waves. When it seemed that the plane was not coming back, Simonson swam for the thing the pilot had dropped. It was a paper, balled up to float. Simonson smoothed it against the upturned hull. It was torn from the corner of an aviation map. In green navigation pencil, the pilot had scribbled, "Mi dispiace."
"He's sorry," said Simonson. "For capsizing us, I suppose."
Clinging to the dinghy, they stared at the point on the horizon where the Italian had become indistinguishable from the sky.
"You never mentioned you knew Italian," said Alistair.
"Mother has a place on Lake Como."
Alistair laughed.
"What?"
said Simonson.
"How gloomy for you that one can no longer travel there."
"Oh, I don't know. Italy always seemed an awfully long way to go for fascism and olives."
"I rather like olives."
"Mother rather liked fascism. We had to burn all the photographs when war was declared."
They worked the boat upright and shivered while they bailed with their shoes. When all was seaworthy, they went back for the trawling line. The wooden spool floated on the water. Simonson retrieved it and began reeling in, but the spinner had sunk to the seabed and snagged something. The line took an age to come. While Simonson worked, Alistair lay back and let the sun warm him. The water lapped the hull, and the idle sails flapped. Storm petrels crackled and purred as they quartered the waves for prey. Simonson could say what he liked, but Alistair liked Malta. This blameless blue sea softened the memories of the retreat through France. Even the enemy's blockade had done him good. After a few sleepless nights with the terrors, the scarcity of alcohol had probably saved him. Now a rare beer made him cheerful. He no longer had to follow it into oblivion. He saw things clearly again. Hilda's smile, the endearing effort she had made to keep her makeup fresh. He decided he would write to her. She might enjoy hearing about the warmth, the cheerful press of locals, the little island out on its own.
"Why don't you take a turn?"
said Simonson. "I've had it." He flopped down in the bottom of the boat and closed his eyes while Alistair took over the job of reeling in the trawl line. It was sluggish and painful work, a foot at a time, with the cord digging into his hands as he heaved it in. The white line angled into deepening blue, with golden coils of sunlight following it down into darkness. After a few minutes, Alistair saw a grey-green looming 30 or 40 feet below.
"Lump of seaweed," he said.
Simonson yawned.
"I've been called worse, and by better-looking men."
As Alistair worked, the shape came closer to the surface and resolved itself into a thing that ought to be recognised, but for the reluctance of the mind. When it was only 20 feet down, Alistair could see it distinctly. The dead man looked back at him with an expression as quiet and clear as the water, and Alistair shivered and took out his pocket knife and cut the line. He put away the knife and watched as the uniformed body rolled onto its front and began the long journey down, trailing blonde hair and the long white filament of fishing line that Alistair watched until it blent with the coiling sunlight and was lost to sight.
"Damn it," he said.
"Hmm?"
said Simonson, half opening an eye.
"Line snapped," said Alistair. "I must have pulled too hard."
"I paid 3 shillings for that gear."
"I'll buy you another set."
"Oh, that's quite all right," said Simonson. "You are miserably poor, and there's nothing down there in any case."
They sailed the dinghy back to the beach and dragged it up through the narrow channel of sand that had been left between the barbed wire entanglements. They lowered the sails, stowed the rudder, and left the boat in its spot for the next officers who got the half-day leave. Their driver had waited for them. As the boat came in, he had harnessed his bony horse between the shafts again, and now they climbed into the open calash for the bumpy ride back to Fort St. Elmo. The sun was sinking over the spine of the island. Alistair shivered as the heat went out of the day. The shadows spread across the yellow rock outcrops and the yellow rock walls. On either side of the road, women in black scratched at the thin earth of fields no bigger than tennis courts. The blades of their hoes rang as they struck the rock beneath the soil. Alistair watched Simonson, his fine black hair still wet, looking out over the scene. He was 22, but looked younger. He was muscled from swimming and sports, and he moved with an athlete's competence. When he walked, he seemed to need the ground only for balance. Now, at rest, his eyes glowed amber in the last of the light. His face was wonderfully kind, in a way that Alistair was certain would infuriate Simonson if he knew. The face had the habit of subverting, with bashful smiles, the harshest of his talk. Simonson wrapped himself in the horse's blanket and scowled at the bucolic scene. Alistair grinned.
"Do you also disapprove of agriculture?"
"I think of the parties we're missing. Every letter I get stinks of champagne and orchestras."
"From what I hear, London is catching hell."
"It is a matter of perspective. With proper planning, one can watch while hell is caught, from the safety of Claridge's roof. My dear elder brother hasn't been sober since this war started."
"Doesn't it bother him to stay behind?"
"Good God, why would it? Randolph has nothing to prove beyond being the firstborn son, to the actuality of which attests a certificate that he keeps in a safe."
"Now I know you're not serious," said Alistair.
"Jealous is what I am. Randy will just be waking up now, in silk sheets, with a nice pink lover on either side, while we cling to this bilious rock."
"Your brother will be called up eventually, I suppose."
Simonson shook his head in simple pity.
"You really don't know how it works, do you?"
"I know how it has worked until now, but this war will change things."
Simonson raised a horrified eyebrow.
"Not unless we lose. And even then, I dare say Mother will have squirreled away a few choice photographs. Any family worth its arms has learned to hedge a few bets."
Alistair's clothes were still sharp with brine. He sucked his shirt cuffs and shivered at the wonder of it. They had foundered in the bay where St. Paul had almost drowned. They were taking the same coast road that Paul must have taken to Valletta. The The horses' shoes rang out, and to the left and right the people in their black clothes merged with the deepening shadows. Below the road, all around the points and crenellations of the bay, the waves bled black ink into the twilight. He would reply to Hilda's letter, and he supposed it would be the start of things between them. Perhaps this was what love was like, after all. Not the lurch of going over a humpback bridge, and not the incandescence of fireworks, just the quiet understanding that one should take a kind hand when it was offered, before all light was gone from the sky. First, though, he would write to Tom. If he had been a prig to Hilda, then he had been an inexcusable ass to his oldest friend. As soon as they got back to the fort, he would write. He would apologise for the way he had been, and he wouldn't blame the war. He would ask Tom to forgive him, and when Tom did, then he could reply to Hilda with an untroubled mind. He felt better now. As the calash bounced along the rocky track, and they wound through the stone walls older than Christ, he felt himself made new by the war, while the cool salt breeze blew in off the sea, and the first star rose in the east. December 1940. Mary sat at the piano and smiled at Tom in the front row. All the children had managed to field at least one parent, which was good work at 3 in the afternoon on a working day reduced to 6 hours by the bombing. They all deserved A for effort. In the front row, Zachary's father sat with Poppy's mother, and next to them were Kenneth's mother and both of Thomas's parents. In the back row, Maud's mother was making a point, it seemed to Mary, of sitting as far from Zachary's father as she could, but at least she had come. There was something about the star rising above the stable that still pulled a crowd in from the fields. She pressed out the last chords of the hymn, let her hands fall to her lap, and nodded for the play to begin. Betty stepped forward into the improvised spotlight that George's father had made from an electric fitting and an empty baked bean can. Betty froze until Mary whispered, "Long ago."
"Long ago," said Betty, "in the city of Nazareth, an angel..."
"Behold," yelled Kenneth, "A, virgin, shall be with child, and..."
"Shh, not yet," hissed Mary.
The boy clamped both hands over his mouth, eyes bulging. Betty said,
"An angel came to Joseph and Mary, and the angel said..."
Mary willed Kenneth to say his line.
"Behold,"
she whispered.
Nothing.
In the front row, the parents were agitated and looking to her. Kenneth was staring up at the ceiling.
"Behold,"
she said again, and still nothing happened. Tom widened his eyes at her and pointed to his ear. Now she heard it, a low rumbling. The air raid sirens began. Mary felt the familiar punch of fear, followed immediately by fury at the enemy. Today of all days they had chosen to start the raid early. She stood from the piano.
"We will go down into the basement. Children first, please, calmly and quietly, holding hands in twos as we practiced."
She issued candles, one to each pair of children, as they went down the basement stair. Poppy went with George, Maud with Kenneth, Zachary with Betty, then Beryl on her own, since she would not let anyone touch her, and finally Thomas in his father's arms, his wheelchair parked in the corridor. Mary had Tom see everyone down the stairs while she went to the boiler room and shut off the electricity, the gas, and the water. Back in the classroom, she checked that no one remained. She tucked the Christ doll under her arm, closed the piano lid, and walked down into the basement. There was a confusion of places and a nervous laughter among the adults. The children squabbled for seats on the two long gymnasium benches that Mary had set up when she cleared the basement. Mary clapped her hands twice.
"Right. Grown-ups, please move these benches as close to that back wall as you can, and sit on them. Leave this space in front clear. This will be our stage. It's less room than we've practiced in, so, shepherds, I need you to keep your flocks close. And, Angel, where are you, Kenneth? Angel, I need you to watch where you flap your wings. Betty and Maud, more candles, please, in these jars, and put them on the floor along the walls. Yes, anywhere is good. And now, children, places as you were, please. And, George, please can you bring that stool for Thomas to sit on? Very good. All right, then, we shall go from And the angel said,
"Behold," said Kenneth, "behold."
In the candlelight, the audience cheered. The children made no more mistakes, and Mary sat to watch them while the distant concussions of the raid sounded through the underground walls. The candle flames shone on the ancient shelves that lined the basement. The yellow light glinted on the dented globes. It glowed on the musty needlework. It made the laid-down maypoles into long bones, white in the darkness. When it came time for the next hymn, Mary took a glockenspiel from its pine box, gripped the wooden beaters, and frowned at the instrument. It might be harder than she had allowed.
"Here," said Zachary's father. "Let me have that. What's the song?"
"No Room in the Inn."
He began straight away, giving two bars and nodding the children in. He played evenly, not making any more fuss of the tune than it needed. Mary closed her eyes while the children sang. Later, when Mary and Joseph had lain the doll in the glockenspiel case that took the place of the manger, and after the last hymn, the play was over, but the bombing raid was not. The explosions came through the ground, no nearer, but no fewer. The children clustered on the benches in the arms of their parents and waited for the all-clear. People spoke in whispers, as if the war were listening. Since there was nothing else to watch, they all looked at the doll in the manger, with the candles ringed around it in jars. Mary sat beside Tom on the end of a bench.
"Feeling Christmassy?"
"As an elf in rum butter." She put her head on his shoulder.
"Like it down here?"
He gave the basement a critical eye. "It could use a woman's touch." She dug him in the ribs.
"I hate you."
"This school is yours now, you know. I mean, after the war, everyone will come home, and I dare say you'll have to hand the place back, but you and I will know who held the line when it mattered."
"Oh, I'll be glad to give the key back. It'll be a relief not to be in charge."
"I don't see you somehow taking orders from Miss Vine. Not after this."
"No?"
"I don't see any of it being as it was. Just look at us, down here in the dark. Coloureds and cripples and cranks. But we're the ones holding on. When the rest get back, they'll have to respect what happened here." Mary yawned and stretched out her legs alongside his.
"I just want to get through. I must say, I don't frightfully care who feels good once this is over, so long as it isn't the Germans."
He grinned. "I don't care about anyone at all, apart from you. If there's one person who..." Three huge detonations came, knocking the breath from their lungs and blowing out the candles. Children and parents screamed. Mary found herself stunned, lying on top of Tom, both of them struggling to get up. She fumbled in her pockets until she found her lighter. Zachary was staring back at her, eyes wide with terror.
"It's all right," she mumbled,
her tongue pasted with brick dust. She was slow from the concussion.
"It's quite all right. Quite safe down here."
Another explosion came, huge and even closer, knocking the lighter from her hand. When she felt for it and flicked it back on, Zachary was gone. His footsteps banged up the wooden stairs that led up from the basement.
"No, wait!"
She made to go after him, but Tom pulled her back. "I'll get him." He went, leaving her to bring order to the tangle of parents and children. She got the candles alight in their jars, then checked on the injuries. Zachary's father was badly concussed, swinging his head in confusion. Thomas's father had dislocated a shoulder and sat on the floor with his back against the wall, green-faced. The children had got away with bruises. Once she had them all calm, she took stock. Her ears rang. She must have struck her head harder than she had thought, but at least the bombing seemed distant, for now. She didn't know how long Zachary and Tom had been gone. 5 minutes, perhaps? She went up into the corridor, stumbling on uneven legs. It seemed she had lost a shoe, and decided to take a quick look outside. She swung open the heavy front door and was amazed to find that it was still daylight. The street was deserted, with rubble strewn across it. A house was down in the middle of the row. She looked up and saw no bombers. She took a few steps into the street, thought better of it, and hurried back into the shelter of the porch. It was ridiculous, of course. It was bombs that threatened, not rain. And yet in the corner of the porch, a wooden box held the parents' furled umbrellas, and a sensible part of her mind realized that she ought to take one, since it must be better than nothing. Her hand was even reaching for one when she saw, through the open door, the child at the end of the street. He was Zachary's build, but white, in a white sweater and shorts, and she yelled at him to come in to cover. The child stared at her, backed away 2 paces, and fled. It was 5 streets before she caught him, with bombs beginning to fall again close by. When she finally got hold of Zachary, his eyes were blank with fright. She dragged him into an angle behind a wall and gasped to get her breath. He cowered, arms raised as if she might strike him, and she wondered how it had come to be that he was white, and she also wondered why he was afraid of her. He was crying tears of a brown liquid, and she would not understand until later that they were ordinary tears, cutting through the white dust.
"Why?" she managed to say. "Why is it always you who runs off?"
he howled, chest heaving.
"I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
She shook her head.
"You have to come back. We can't stay out here." "I'm not going back in the basement."
"Oh, yes, you jolly well are." She half dragged, half led him back through the air raid, which was all around them now, and in the mouth of a side street she saw that Tom was lying on the pavement, asleep in the snow with the winter sun slanting over him. It was a stress reaction she had read about, the mind shutting down when it all got too much. She would have to go back for him as soon as she had delivered Zachary to the shelter. How extraordinary that she was the one who was calm in this situation, who could take in everything clearly and without panic. She hauled Zachary back to Hawley Street, with the bombing seeming distant again, and here there was an interesting phenomenon. How glad her father would be to know that his daughter could be cool in a crisis. This was how it sounded in her mind, as she held Zachary by his thin wrist and felt the pulse in it while the drone note of the bombers faded away into the east.
"I am witnessing a phenomenon related to the bombing."
The thing was that Hawley Street was there, but the school was gone. She walked up and down the length of the street, twice, calmly but briskly, pulling Zachary by the wrist and looking for the school. Because, of course, the phenomenon would have a simple explanation. Perhaps that someone unfamiliar with the area had taken the building and put it back in slightly the wrong place. She started laughing, because it was silly that one couldn't find something so big and stolidly Victorian as Hawley Street School. All she could find was an enormous pile of red bricks, dotted with decorative London yellows. What a ridiculous place to leave bricks! And this was when her stomach fell, and she understood that the problem was a perceptual one, that her concussion was worse than she had supposed, that she was hallucinating. It was frightening, but at least it all made sense now. Zachary turned white, Tom fast asleep, the school absent without leave. How funny the mind could be. She sat in the thick white dust and laughed. Afterwards, they told her it was normal, with shock. Someone came and took Zachary away from her. They had to prise her fingers off his wrist. And then for hours, all she could think was what a waste it was. A new carton of chalk had been delivered that morning, and now it must be ruined, all 20 sticks of it. She explained to a nurse that they would simply have to make do and write on the blackboard with the stubs of old chalk. They took her to a rest centre and wrapped her tight in blankets. They told her that it helped to be swaddled like a baby. Days passed, which she experienced as the daylight flickering on and off, as if there were a bad connection. They told her that no bodies had been recovered from inside the school, only fragments. The only body was Tom's, recovered from the street, and they unwrapped her from the blankets long enough for her to be taken to identify him. The morgue was an improvised facility, in a church hall. Someone had marked Tom's forehead with an X, in red grease, pencil. It meant that there was an internal injury. They told her Tom had been killed by the pressure wave of a bomb, which was why there wasn't a mark on his body except for that X. Mary hardly heard them. It was evident to her that the bomb had done nothing to him, that the cause of death must somehow be connected to that terrible letter on his forehead, the unknown in all algebras, the singularity. She explained this to the woman who was seeing to her in between signing for the deliveries of the remains that were still arriving at the morgue, in 16-inch rectangular cardboard containers requisitioned from a grocer, as and when the heavy rescue men brought them out. Her mother flashed on and off. She told Mary that the heavy rescue crews had dug into the rubble for 4 days and nights, bringing out what remains they could, and then they had put lime down. People asked questions of her. Mary answered that she was quite all right, thank you. No, she did not need more tea. Yes, she was able to supply a list of the pupils and parents who had been present at the nativity play. No, she and Tom had not been engaged. She had been waiting for the poor man to pluck up courage. No, she did not think that if God had seen fit to spare only one child, then it was a pity it had to be the pickaninny. No, she did not think that the darkies had the devil's own luck. No, she imagined that the poor child had run out into the air raid simply because he was unusually resistant to sitting where he was told. Well, and if they must put it like that, then yes, she was rather fond of the nigger. There were no further questions after that, and Mary did not have the heart to trouble people with her own. Goodness knew everyone at the rest centre was exhausted. Everyone had anguish of their own by now. What was every bomb that fell, if not endings under unbelievable compression? Grief was contagious, and Mary would no more speak of her own than she would cough in a crowded train carriage without putting her hand to her mouth. And so she sat and watched the walls in the grubby rest centre, with its pinboard still announcing church business and cake raffles. She read the small advertisements for odd jobmen and cat breeders. She reminded herself to thank Tom, the next time she saw him, for going out into the raid after Zachary. A moment later, she understood that this would not be possible, but the understanding did not prevent her from writing it down on a scrap of paper and tucking it into her sleeve. Remember to thank Tom. He had left the shelter to go into the thick of a bombing raid. That he was dead, and that she must thank him the next time she saw him. For weeks it was possible to believe both these things at once. Quite early on, even before the days slowed their flickering and began to come and go with their usual shopkeeper's frequency, Mary decided that she would never speak of how she felt. One could only trudge away from the place to which one had hurried in such hope at the start. One could only begin again, a year older, and resolved to carry oneself in such a way that the pressure wave of the tragedy was contained within one's own body and could not spread one inch further. December 1940. On Christmas Day, the regiment hosted the companies of all the convoy escort ships tucked into Grand Harbour. In sunshine, more than 1,000 officers and men assembled in the courtyard of Fort St. Elmo for a service of 9 lessons and carols and a tot of Nelson's blood supplied by the visiting navy. 500 years of tradition having established the order of service, the rum was administered before the singing. Though the enemy's blockade was biting and supplies on the island were scarce, Alistair supposed the War Office had established a vast cache of polishes. 2,000 black boots glowed as if with an inner light. 12 trumpets, 8 trombones, 4 tubas, and a euphonium blazed like the armour of Achilles. It was the genius of motivated men that even when rendered impotent by conditions of total encirclement, they could make themselves preternaturally shiny. As the last chorus of O Come All Ye Faithful reached its triumph, Alistair was nearly blinded. After the service, he sent the men of his battery for a second trip to the rum urn, with instructions to make only a mild nuisance of themselves. He went up to his little cell high in the walls of the fort. When his subaltern, Briggs, dropped by with an airmail fresh from the airfield, Alistair could have kissed the envelope. Warm from the Navy's liquor, he really did feel a glow of goodwill towards all men, even those of the enemy persuasion. It was big of the Italian aviators to let a mail plane through the blockade on Christmas Day. One hoped that one's own side was reciprocating in some other theatre where Britain was in the ascendant. One struggled to think where that might be. But at Christmas, one could think of sleigh bells instead. The aerogram bore Tom's parents' address in the sender box. Alistair tore it open. How perfect that Tom's reply should reach him on Christmas Day. Assuming, of course, that Tom was writing to forgive him for the awkwardness of the Lyceum, then how apt. The letter was from Tom's father. The handwriting was almost like Tom's, but slightly slumped, He was sorry to have to let Alistair know that Tom had been killed on the 19th of December in an air raid. Since Tom had thought of him as a brother, Alistair was to think of the Shaws as family and to write if there was ever anything they could do. Alistair put down the letter and stood at the Arrow Loop window. He watched the forenoon glittering over the sea. In the distant haze he could just make out the flashing signal mirrors of the Italian blockade ships. If one forgot for a moment that the messages wished one evil, they were beautiful. He washed off the parade grime by sponging himself from his metal basin. He put on a fresh shirt, and since there was still half an hour before Christmas lunch was to be served, he visited the men in their mess room. Post would have come for them too, and one couldn't second-guess the mood of the men. Airmail had the particular violence of recency. It might leave them upbeat, or homesick, or a queer mix of the two, and so it was prudent for their officer to drop by and project a soothing equanimity. Sweethearts might blow cold or hot after all, and mothers might ail or improve, but the 3.7-inch heavy anti-aircraft gun would always provide a stable firing platform, providing that the levelling jacks on each corner of its carriage were competently deployed. This was the sentiment an officer should diffuse. He spent a brisk 20 minutes with the men, made a joke of their minor gripes and a note of their major ones, and reached the officer's mess in time for grace. Army and Navy together, they were 60 seated at 2 long tables, with Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton presiding. Alistair was last to arrive, and he hurried to his place, nodding his apology. Hamilton returned an affable nod, then bowed his head in prayer.
"Lord," he said, "on this holiest of days, we thank you for food and ammunition. May our ships get through and the enemies get lost."
They all said amen, and then the orderlies brought in something that the cook had made out of breadcrumbs and canned malevolence. Alistair lifted the corner of his with a fork.
"I don't know whether to put mustard on it or marmalade."
"Or whether to eat it or give it a Christian burial," said Simonson. "Did Santa bring you any post?"
"Not this time."
"Maybe you weren't nice. Cheery bastard keeps a list, you know."
"Whereas you..."
Simonson twirled his knife like a swagger stick.
"I had 4 letters from 3 girls. They all think they're the only one, of course."
"I'm sure you're the only millionaire they write to."
"You don't know the right sort of girl, is your problem. When we go on leave, I'll introduce you around town."
"I fear that your sort of girls would cut my poor body to ribbons simply by using their accent."
Simonson ignored him.
"Of course, if I can just make major before we go back, then my damned brother shan't have the last laugh after all. When one is a major, dear God, the women one can have. I shall bag a gorgeous debutante and parade her in silks before Randolph's hag of a wife."
"I suppose it's lucky the Germans started all this for you."
Simonson frowned.
"Is everything quite all right? You seem out of sorts."
"I'm weary from all the excitement."
"Damn it, Alistair. If you get all out of shape over a brass band, wait until you see some real action."
"Do remind me to tell you about my trip to France one day."
"Exchange visit, was it?"
"We exchanged withering fire, if that counts."
"And do you still keep in touch?"
"Oh, yes. You see, I'm hoping to go back one day."
"But in all seriousness, what's wrong?"
For a moment, Alistair considered telling him. But of course it wasn't the right thing. The war, after all, was a legal riot and a bright pageant and a marvel of near misses. It was a perfect adventure until proved otherwise, and so it would hardly be a kindness on Christmas Day to produce evidence. One pulled crackers for the snap of their mild detonation. Simonson patted him on the back and told him to buck up, and they ate with the chatter of their brother officers around them. For dessert, the cook had turned up tinned apricots. They had them in the smallest bowls, but the fruit still looked lost. Each officer had exactly 2.5 little apricot halves in a 1/4 inch of clear syrup. They drank water from the fort's well, which tasted of its own yellow limestone sides and whatever Turks and Moors had been thrown down there over the centuries. Hamilton stood and tapped his glass for silence.
"The King."
They all rose.
"The King."
They drank his health in well water and left in ones and twos, hungry. Alone, Alistair set Tom's jar of blackberry jam in the arrow loop window and stared at it until a thin moon rose over the sea. January 1941. In the place they had made for him in the chorus at the Lyceum, with 12 singers to his left and 11 to his right, Zachary stood in the red glow of lights that cast fire over a great painted backdrop of London. Its monuments were shattered, its walls breached. In front of him, at centre stage, the new interlocutor spoke to the audience in a deep voice modelled upon Zachary's father's. Staring at the man's back, seeing him silhouetted in the red light, Zachary believed that it really could be his father. He tried to make it true by force of will. He did not want to imagine it was impossible. His father had vanished and left no body behind, like an illusionist or a saint. But every time the new interlocutor spoke, Zachary knew his father was gone.
"And so, ladies and gentlemen, for this our final number tonight, we remember all those who have perished in this beloved city of ours, the city of mankind, and we remember that there is another city, both identical to ours and superordinate to it, where death has no dominion."
The chorus began the hymn, and Zachary joined in as best he could. As they sang, the floodlights brightened, and in their soft glow a new backdrop was revealed, London rebuilt and restored. But more than that, every spire was taller, every bridge broader, each old familiar landmark improved. As the red floods brightened, they were no longer flames, but the glow of the sunrise. Yellow and white lights joined the red until eternal London shone in the full light of day. As the singers threw back their heads to raise the final chorus, the audience rose to its feet. Zachary felt nothing, except perhaps a dull surprise that they bought it. When the curtain came down, the manager took him aside. They stood in the wings, while from the auditorium came the muttering, shuffling sound of the audience departing.
"You're winning, big man,"
said the manager. Zachary smiled.
"Sure?"
"Because from where I stood, I had 23 souls in my chorus, and then I had you."
"I'm sorry. I'll try harder."
"You do that. Happy Negroes, that's what we serve here. One sad coon in my chorus, it's a hole in my bucket. All the magic leaks away, you know?"
Zachary shrugged.
"Maybe I can take a break?"
"And do what? So long as you're for sleeping in my basement, I'm for getting some work in return."
"I could play piano in the interval."
"With that long face, I'd sooner give the gig to a German."
"I could bust the tables then?"
The manager gave a weary look.
"I've got 40 kids queuing up for that chorus. I'd just as soon take you off it, but all my players would say, 'Give the boy a slot, you owe it to his father.' And before I know it, I've traded one sad face for 9. So come on, why won't you sing?"
Zachary shrugged again and said nothing.
"You shy? 'Cause you've got a nice voice. I wouldn't march you down to Parlophone to cut a disc, but I wouldn't pour lead in my ears either."
"It isn't that."
"What then? This is your break. You'd rather the street?"
Zachary hung his head.
"I'd rather something."
The manager laughed.
"Think if you hold out long enough, I'll open up my other box of jobs for Negroes who can't write their name. What is it you're holding out for? Pope or Prime Minister?"
Zachary said nothing, and finally the manager sighed.
"All right, bust my tables then. Collect the tips, and good luck to you. But the job doesn't pay. Sleep in my basement. If you want a wage, then you'll damn well sing in my show. Got that?"
Zachary nodded. Afterwards, when the players were gone, Zachary lit a candle and went down alone to the basement. He sat with a metal basin between his knees and a mirror propped against the wall at the end of the bench. With a cloth and cold water, he scrubbed off the white grease paint lips and the white rings around his eyes. He clasped his hands.
"Sorry, Dad."
There was no answer, though he listened for one in the silence.
"I'm sorry,"
he said again. Nothing. The darkness in the basement was frightening. It scuttled and knocked. A month had not cured him of the fear of it. He curled up under drapes in the corner, but sleep would not come.
"Are you there?"
he said, in the lowest voice he could. He waited. His candle seemed to flicker, and perhaps this meant that his father was there.
"I don't know what to do."
In the silence, in the endless underground night, the candle flame seemed to be steadier. Perhaps his father meant that he ought to be steadied too. Zachary squeezed his eyes shut and pulled the drapes tight against the dark. January 1941. Mary sat with Hilda on the train back from Tom's funeral. His had been the only body available to be buried. To each of the other families, she had made do with sending flowers. Even this had been made difficult by the war, the Dutch blooms being no longer considered essential cargo, and the English hothouses having been given over to food production. She had turned up a few early snowdrops, some forced hyacinths. She had hesitated to send them, uncertain if they would be a comfort. In their compartment, Hilda smoked and jabbed at the Times crossword with a self-propelling pencil. She was likely, Mary felt, to infuriate the puzzle rather than to solve it.
"It was kind of you to come," said Mary.
"I could hardly let you go with Palmer." Mary managed a smile.
"Palmer might have brought brandy."
"Palmer might have exchanged places with the deceased. Is that not among his duties?" The train shrieked steam into the plunging clouds. It didn't lighten them. It had been an impossible way to meet Tom's parents for the first time. In the church, Mary hadn't known her place. It had seemed presumptuous to sit with the family, and so she and Hilda had gone to the back. Tom's mother had fetched them and brought them wordlessly to the first pew. All through the service, Mary had looked straight ahead at Tom's coffin beneath its lilies, wondering where they were from.
"They are lovely flowers,"
Mary had said at the end.
"I went over to Cheltenham for them," said Tom's mother.
Tom was dead, and lilies were available, and to Mary these things were equally incomprehensible. They had walked out into flurries of snow. Four men, too old or infirm for the war, had lowered Tom's coffin into the ground on short ropes reserved for the purpose. The vicar had said, "Death, where is thy sting?" There was a consensus that one couldn't feel a thing. 3 hours later, in the train, her body was still taut with the cold and the unreleased emotion. Yawning on warped rails, their train approached London Bridge. On either side of the line, 1,000 buildings were blown out.
"What do you suppose you'll do?" said Hilda. "I must find Zachary, first of all."
"And then what?"
"Taking home to your mother? She'll be thrilled." "I've a responsibility to him." "You've nothing of the sort. He was in my class, and..."
"And nothing. You were ordered to teach that class grammar, not to adopt any survivors."
"Now you're just being horrid."
"Only because you're being ridiculous. Where would it end if you went after him? You're not his family, or even his species. You can't give him a home. That's his people's job. And you shan't tell me he doesn't have people, because there were dozens and dozens at that theatre, conveniently colour-coded."
"The Negroes aren't all related, you know."
Hilda paused, the idea seeming to strike her for the first time.
They might be different tribes, but I dare say they put down the spears in times like these. At least I should check that someone is taking him in."
"Then make your inquiries if you must, but swear you won't promise that boy something you could never make good on. I know what a mule you can be when you get a notion in your head. You'd make the boy an exile from his people, and you a pariah among yours. It would be miserable for both of you."
"You're right, of course. And yet..."
"And yet nothing. You must think only of yourself and what you want to do. If you don't get on with your own life, you'll be no use to others at all."
"I think I'd like to teach again."
Hilda gave an exasperated groan.
"It would make Tom glad," said Mary.
"You shan't live your life to make Tom glad." Mary lit a cigarette and watched the devastation roll by. These had been the city. These clubs and churches. These ordered landmarks. London had fitted her so perfectly that she had mistaken its shape for her own. Now each bomb was a breach in the carapace, laying bare the living nerve. she said. It's easy to say.
Because it's true, said Hilda. You must live on your terms.
The loosened rails rattled as the train crept above the embankment. Steam billowed over the grey river. On both banks, facades were down and buildings gaped. Mary had always supposed that she could endure if London could, but here the great old Nautilus lay gasping and cracked at the throat of the Thames, at the place where sweet water met salt.
"Let's go for lunch at Claridge's," said Hilda. "You need a good feed."
"I'm not hungry."
"But you really must eat. You're thin as a harlot's excuse."
"I think I shall go for a walk."
"Then at least take me along. You're in no state to be on your own."
Mary took her hand.
"You've done more than enough. You've always been good to me. And I know I don't make it easy."
Hilda nodded.
"You're like a bad gun dog. One can either put it down or make it the family pet."
"I'm only pleased you've found a use for me."
"Just don't pee on my rugs, and promise you'll consult me before you even think about teaching again."
As the train came into the platform, they took their bags from the rack and disembarked. They embraced, and Hilda dissolved into steam. Once she was gone, Mary leaned into a corner for a while. No one interrupted her. Half the city wept into wolves now. Afterwards, she stood for a while on the empty platform. She pulled her gloves on and herself together and walked out into the streets. Everywhere there was rubble. Bathtubs lay exposed, their yellow ducts ice-bound. Beds in which women had been conceived and born and then conceived in and laboured in themselves, those brass theatres of involuntary dialogue, now lay silent and bent, seesawing on bisected floors, weeping duck down into the street. The feathers swirled with the snow. It was too much for her. How easily she was discouraged now, and she fled into a cafe and drank straw-coloured tea. She wrote to the manager at the Lyceum, asking if Zachary's whereabouts were known. When it was done and folded, the flat taste of the envelope gum lingered. In the maps in the newspaper they brought her, the enemy's swastikas were pressed up against the neighbouring coasts, so close that one could look up from the page and almost smell the diesel and the sweat. In the Atlantic, the U-boats completed the encirclement. On the inside pages of the paper were endless notices. London's districts had been divided and subdivided as the lines of communication shrank. There were 10 new rules if one lived here, 12 if one lived there. This was the place she had grown up in, whose singular law had recently applied from Bombay to Belize. A great, extrovertive city was besieged. Slowly, the feeling returned that had come over her when she first took charge of her school. What one felt towards the enemy, finally, was fury. She pushed the cold tea away and walked through the snow to Tom's old office at the Education Authority. In the lobby, she knocked the snow off her boots and told the receptionist that she wouldn't leave until she was seen. They let her up to see the new man, who was called Cooper. As he rose to greet her, he seemed to become blocked between his chair and the desk. He straightened ineffectually.
"Please," said Mary. "No need to get up."
He sank back down, apologising with a vague gesture for what Mary took to be a bad back, or limited physical grace, or apathy. Cooper was older than Tom. She put him in his mid-30s. He was fair and slightly overweight. He had a moustache growing in. Behind him on the wall of the office was a small watercolour of Hampstead Heath that she had given to Tom in the summer. She had laughed until she gasped for breath as she watched Tom hang it there one evening when his colleagues had all gone home. He had needed 3 nails and 7 profanities. Afterwards they had been quite indiscreet, and a great deal of paperwork had fallen from the desk to the floor. Tom had always kept his desk in such a mess. Cooper saw her looking at the picture.
"It's Hampstead Heath."
"Is it?" Mary caught herself saying, quite automatically. How soon one became diminished. The man made a gesture that was imprecisely dismissive. Whether of her or the Heath or the watercolour, she couldn't judge.
"Dreadful, I'm afraid," he said.
Mary felt a sadness as weary as his manner. Of course the poor man dismissed the painting. Such was the past, after all. It left the present cluttered with objects the survivors were immune to. She sat, folded her gloves in her lap, and lit a cigarette. He clasped his hands on the immaculate desk and looked down at his cuffs as though she might have asked his permission. There was an ashtray, Tom's, the heavy blue glass with the ambiguous inclusion in the heart of it that Mary had always rather hoped was an eyeball. Since Cooper made a point of not sliding the ashtray across the desk towards her, she made a point of using the carpet. She said, "I should like to be assigned a new school. My preference is for primary, but if the only vacancies are at secondary, then I can teach French, Latin, and composition, as it says in my file. I am available immediately."
"Do you not think," said Cooper, after a moment, "that under the circumstances it might be better to wait a while before you go back to work?"
"Wait for what? For children to forget their times tables? For H's to be dropped in great mounds?" He humoured her with a smile.
"I'm sure you know what I mean."
"But I'm quite all right. I'm unharmed and able to return to duty."
There was a long silence. "Must I spell out these sensitivities?"
"I'd rather you gave me a job." Cooper wouldn't return her smile. He stood, apparently it was not so hard after all, and walked across the office. With his back to her and his hands clasped behind it, he looked out at the snow.
"My predecessor was very young, and decided to reopen some schools. I'm afraid the excitement of promotion got the better of his judgment."
Mary shook her head. "His duty was to provide school places."
Cooper gave her the tone reserved for a child who had got the answer jolly nearly correct.
"Our duty, since you used the word, is to send the message that London, under the circumstances, is not the right place for the young."
"And yet there are children the countryside won't take."
"But I don't make the policy, and the policy is one of full evacuation."
"Then what are we to do with the crooked and the coloured and the slow? Are we to let them rot, simply because it is not policy for them to exist?"
"If you must split hairs, it is policy that such children exist, but it is not politic for them to be schooled here."
"Does it not seem that what you say is monstrous?"
Cooper turned from the window.
"What is monstrous is that 7 children and their parents are dead because my predecessor saw fit to let you play the pretty schoolmarm while the grown-ups were using the city for war."
Mary blinked once, twice, then recovered herself. She fixed the man with a slight arch of the eyebrow as she lit a new cigarette. He returned her gaze unsteadily.
"I suppose we both wish we could undo it."
Her hands shook.
"We were hardly doing ballet on the roof. We were underground in the shelter. People are killed in shelters every day."
"Well, it won't happen in any school of mine."
"Apparently not, if neither will any teaching."
He patted her on the shoulder.
"You're emotional, because you were so caught up. You're charming and young, and I don't hold what happened against you. The one who should have known better is my predecessor."
"Tom was my lover. It is well known. Won't you stop speaking as if we weren't both aware?"
"I'm trying to protect your feelings and the name of your family."
"You might best serve both by letting me teach. There are hundreds of children in this district, you know full well. One sees them in every street, poking around in the rubble."
"I'm afraid there's no position for you."
"I apologise for becoming emotional. Please, let me teach again."
"Take a break," he said. "God knows I would if I could. Get out of town for a few weeks. Blow away the cobwebs."
She turned her back on him. In the little watercolour she had given Tom, the light was yellow and frisky. If you went at that light with an egg whisk, you could work up a froth to stand a spoon in. London stretched away beyond the heath. The landmarks stood. They had been so firmly attached back then that the artist had had to paint the sky around them. She went to the window.
"What can I do to change your mind?"
He said nothing. She moved closer, letting her arm brush against his as she smoked.
"We needn't put this city back the way we found it, you know."
He gave an amused look that turned into something more serious.
"Look," he said, "it's overdue lunch. Why don't you and I go for a bite and discuss it?
She tilted her head up to his, giving him the full benefit of her eyes. For a moment she let him drown himself.